Hello and welcome to the Take One podcast from All Sociology, part of the Edify Network. My name's Ben, and if you haven't tuned into this podcast before, it's me, a sociologist and sociology teacher, banging on about an issue of sociological importance for somewhere between half an hour to an hour. Sometimes it'll be on a topic that's directly related to an A-level, GCSE or undergraduate sociology course, and other times it'll just be me riffing about something related to the subject I teach and the subject I love. Every podcast comes to you live and direct from All Sociology Towers, aka my pokey little gaff in the east of England, and each one's done on the first and only take, hence the name Take One. Every episode aims to help you better understand sociology, and I try to make them as accessible as I can. There's no fancy editing, no bells and whistles, it's just pure, uncut All Sociology. But enough of that, let's get down to business. Hello and welcome to episode number 17 of the Take One podcast from All Sociology. My name's Ben, and if you haven't yet tuned into the podcast before, this podcast is all about sociology and it aims to help students understand some of the things that we're going to look at in your courses, whether it be at GCSE, A-level or indeed undergraduate. Now, welcome back, because it's been a while since I've been on air. I'm unfortunately back to school being a teacher, so haven't had as much chance to do podcasts as I like to. This one today is a whistle-stop tour of some of the key terms you're going to come across when you're studying the topic of crime and deviance, which most of you will be, regardless of what level you study at. So what we're going to do today is we're going to explain in simple language some of these key terms, what they mean, and we're going to throw in a few case studies and some examples along the way, as well as give you a couple of things to watch on Netflix to maybe take your understanding a little bit further. I'm delighted to say that today I'm joined by my very good friend, Leanne. Hey, Leanne.
Hello.
Hey, how are you? You all right?
Yep, good, thank you.
Good. So it's been a while since we've seen each other, and even longer since we did a podcast together, so we're quite happy to be back together doing one of these today. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of it, I'll give a couple of shout-outs to every new student of sociology, whether you're at school, uni or college. Well done on making the right choice. Also shout out to everyone who's gone off to uni to study sociology and is dealing with the terrible coronavirus lockdowns in your freshers weeks. We feel incredibly sorry for you. Shout out to all the new followers on Instagram and any of my listeners that has bought a mug. So well done if you've got yourself an All Sociology mug. Leanne's just now got one of her own. If you want one of them, you can get in touch with me. Anyway, let's cut to the chase and talk about what we're going to go through today. So we're going to cover the following kind of concepts. We're going to go through crime, deviance, situational crime, historic crime, the social construction of crime, the criminal justice system in the UK, white-collar crime and corporate crime, the differences between those two, a little bit of state crime, a little bit of green crime, and of course, we're going to finish off with the globalisation of crime. So what better place to start then? What is crime? Well, very simply, crime is an action that breaks the law. Now, I'm not going to insult everyone's intelligence by saying what examples of crimes there are, but there are a whole load of examples you could possibly take. And an action against the law, for instance, the law says you're not allowed to take a life, so please don't kill people. Now, the difference between crime and deviance is that deviance is just an action that goes against the norms or the values of society. It's not about breaking a law per se, it's just about something that might happen that's unexpected in that particular social situation. So, for instance, the law says absolutely nothing about you having a loud conversation in a library or in a cinema, but it definitely goes against socially accepted norms and values in those particular settings. Also, remember here that crime is nearly screwed up then straight away. We haven't prepared for this as per usual. Remember, crime is nearly always deviant, but deviance is not necessarily criminal. Now, what I mean by this is that not absolutely all crime is deviant. Most of it will be, but I'll give you an example that might sort of like make you think a little bit. So deviance being something that goes against the norms of society. Well, actually, if you think about when you break the... Well, not say when you, when someone breaks the law, like it's normal, and you might go 31 miles an hour in a 30 miles an hour limit. Now, technically, you're breaking the law there, but actually, given that most drivers have probably done that at some point, and many will do that every day, you could argue that that act of breaking the law isn't actually deviant, because it's something that most people do. So there we've just gone through the differences between crime, which is an action that breaks the law, and deviance, which is just an action that goes against the norms or values of society, not necessarily breaking any laws. The next one we're going to talk about is a little bit about what we call situational crime or historic crime, and ultimately we're going to head towards the social construction of crime. So I'm going to start off with something called situational crime, and this is basically an act that is only a crime or deemed criminal in a particular situation. So I've got a couple of ideas about this, and Leanne's got a couple of examples as well. I'll give you mine first of all. My example of situational crime would be that if you're 16 and you're going to buy a beer in the UK, that is illegal because the legal age of drinking or purchasing alcohol in the UK is 18. However, if you're 16, you can legally go and buy a beer or a glass of wine in any or many European countries. However, if you are in America, United States of America, you're going to need to wait until you're 21 to buy alcohol. So we can just see there, through using the purchasing of alcohol as an example, in France, you only need to be 16, in the UK, you need to be 18, and in America, you need to be 21.
Well, as you're bringing in alcohol, we could always bring in drugs.
Go on there, might as well.
Yeah, so you could say the same sort of thing, couldn't you? So in some countries, it's obviously illegal to smoke marijuana, like in this country. But in Amsterdam, you know, you can go there and it's perfectly legal.
Well, absolutely. I mean, while we're talking about Amsterdam, let's talk about prostitution and sex work as well. Because if you've ever been to Amsterdam, you will notice, if you've been down to the red light district, that you will see lots of windows full of varying levels of attractiveness of women in scantily clad clothes. And that's because prostitution and sex work has been decriminalised in Holland, and they keep a very open policy to it. Yeah. Whereas in Britain, very different indeed. Yeah. I think the other thing as well, like thinking about drugs there, we mentioned in the States and Canada, Portugal, cannabis is legal. In fact, in Portugal, I think they've decriminalised every kind of drug. Yeah. And it's actually had quite a positive effect on their ability to deal with drug use and those kinds of
things. Taking away the label of it, which links in with your topic on labelling theory, doesn't it? About this idea of, does labelling and having laws governing our behaviour actually encourage crime? If you take away the labels, do you get rid of the crime problem?
Absolutely, 100%. All right, so the other thing I'm going to say is, some of you might well be sat there right now thinking, well, I can technically go and have a drink when I'm 16 in the UK, and actually buying a beer is technically legal. Yes, it is technically, but only if you have it with a meal, only if your mum or your dad or a grown adult buys it, and only if they're with you while you drink it. So whilst you can do that, you're under so many kind of restrictions that you basically might as well not be able to drink, okay? Talking about historical deviance, so situational deviance and situational crime, some things are crime in different situations to others. Often we think geographically, but we can also consider like historic crime and historic deviance. So again, I'm going to follow that theme of drinking, because as for regular
seems
listeners,
to be on your mind.
Yes, it does. Yeah, I mean, I think both Leanne and I both like a drink, and that might just go with the patch of being a sociology teacher. I don't know, but I did a little bit of research. I actually did find this out. Now, I worked out that over 100 years ago, if you were 16 in the UK, you could absolutely 100% legally buy a beer, because the law was only changed in 1923 under the Intoxicating Liquor Act. Now, in fact, the law was gradually tightened in the preceding years to that, and it was only in 1886 that the first law was introduced around making drinking alcohol illegal. And the first version of that Intoxicating Liquor Act just prevented sale of alcohol to anyone under the age of 13. So if you were 12, no boozing, but as soon as you hit 13, you could have as much to drink as you like, which is crazy, man, because it's only really like 150 years ago.
Yeah. There are other examples of historic sort of differences in crime. Obviously, things like rape within marriage only recently in the 90s became illegal. Things like abortion, obviously, you could apply situational to that as well, because obviously different countries have different abortion laws. Gay marriage. So there's quite a lot of historical sort of examples out there.
I think one of the things, that's absolutely right, and what we're really moving towards here is this idea that crime is not universal, it's relative, and what we mean by that is it's not the same everywhere, it changes according to the context in which you are, so the country in which you are, or indeed the time in which you are, even the culture of the country in which you live. So if you're ever thinking about how can I explain relativity of crime, how comes it's different in some places as others, think about some of the topics we've just talked about: booze, drugs and sex. So, you know, that gives you an excuse to talk about that, I suppose. Anything else to say on that, Leanne?
I don't think so. Just that we call this, the fact that it differs between time and place, it's socially constructed. So that would be a good term to bring into your essays. And of course, you could use that for most conclusions. So if you ever get an essay that argues, you know, is this the best way to explain crime? Is this the best way to explain crime? You've got to consider the fact that definitions of crime are relative. So it's doubtful that one you know, meta-narrative like feminism or Marxism is actually any good at explaining all types of crime, because inevitably there'll be some types of crimes that they leave out.
Absolutely. And just to be absolutely clear, if anyone's unsure what we mean by social construction, what we mean by that is that what we consider to be a crime has been decided by humans at some point. It's not like these things naturally occur in the natural world. So humans have had to come up with the idea that something is a crime or something is not a crime. And that now depends upon the society in which you live, according to whether something is a crime or not. So, again, go back to the examples of drinking beer and those kind of things.
And deviance, of course, is also socially constructed. And I like those HSBC adverts that they had a few years ago, where I think there was one where this man goes into a house and he has a meal. And, of course, when in this culture, if you eat your meal and you complete it, it's a sign of good manners. Mm. Well, in whatever country he'd visited, it was a sign that you aren't full.
Mm.
So he kept finishing his plate, and then the lady kept bringing out more, and he's thinking, oh, I'm going to have to finish some more. And it's, you know, just highlights how norms and values do differ across different cultures.
Just as you've mentioned that, like the other example I always think of is like signs and signifiers. So I'm quite into my semiotics. And
right.
If you make the OK symbol, so you know what the OK symbol looks like? I'm doing it to the camera, not the camera, to the microphone, but you can't see me. Yeah. But you all know what the OK symbol looks like when you move your index finger and your thumb in the shape of an O and you hold your hand up. In most countries, that means everything's okay. But I think if you do that in, I think it's somewhere in the Middle East, it means you're calling someone an arsehole. So don't do that. So just think about the ways that things can change according to the time and the place in which we are. Going back to the UK, I just wanted to briefly cover what we call the criminal justice system in the UK, or more commonly the CJS. And what the criminal justice system is, it's the system and the processes that we have in this country of dealing with crime. It's like almost like our official system of formal social control. So I did this actually with a class the other day, and I asked them, like, you know, put yourself in the position of imagine you get arrested. What happens next? Mm. And everyone just said, oh, you go to court. But there's actually a huge amount of sort of processes and steps that happen before that goes on. So just imagine you were to get arrested, and presumably the police would arrest you. You'd then be taken down to the police station for an interview. And following that interview, you'd either be bailed, which means to be released pending further inquiries, or you'd be released without charge. Now, if you were bailed and you would eventually be asked to come back to the police station, where they would either charge you or they wouldn't charge you with the crime that they've been suspicious of you committing. If you're then charged, you will then go to court. So it's only when basically you have been charged with a crime that you will end up going to court. Now, it's not just the police that make that decision about whether someone should go to court or not, i.e. have they committed that crime. There's another group involved called the Crown Prosecution Service, or the CPS, who basically the police, once they've had an interview with you and they've decided whether they are going to look to take you to court or not, they have to ask the CPS for permission to check whether they've got sufficient evidence for that case to go to court. So many cases of people who have been basically guilty of things haven't gone to court because the CPS don't think there's sufficient evidence to make a conviction. But in cases where they do think there is evidence, you'll go to court, you'll be sentenced according to any kind of number of sanctions. So it might be a prison sentence, it might be a fine, something else. And then eventually you'll be picked up. That's what we call the judicial system that deals with that kind of process. And not the police, not the CPS necessarily, but it's the judicial system, so judges and juries and stuff. And then finally, if you were to get a sentencing, say a prison sentence, that would then be the penal system, which always gets a laugh in my lessons. I don't know why. Same as the Divorce Reform Act 1969. I just don't get it personally. Some jokes flying over my head. But then we've also got the prison system as well, which we refer to as the penal system.
So what you've covered there is quite a lot of scope for essays and questions for paper three. So we do tend to have a lot of questions around sentencing and courts and whether or not it's a fair system, the judicial system, looking at things like the chivalry thesis and doubly deviant theory. And then of course with the prisons, it being, you know, the height of a tough sanction, whether prisons work, what's their aim, what's their role. So we've got quite a few bits to cover, perhaps at a different
Yeah, absolutely.
Time.
I thought I just thought it's kind of useful to know that because I don't think a lot of young people actually know the process.
And you seem to know it quite well.
No comment. No, I've just been watching an awful lot. To be honest, I've been watching Criminal UK on Netflix. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
It's really good. It's not really good. It's actually quite trashy, but it's all about police just investigating one crime. It's all a drama, and so every episode is like an hour. It will just be taking place in the interview room, and it's basically the battle between the interviewers and the accused, I suppose, is the word we need there. But yeah, really good. So go and check that out if you want to have a bit of an understanding.
Also, Radio 4 at the moment are doing a lot of programmes around criminology as well. And last night on The Spark, I think it was called, they were talking about whether or not the criminal justice system works and if it's effective because we've got mass incarceration and whether or not the right people are in prison. And these sorts of debates are, of course, what could come up in the exam.
Absolutely. So that's a great point there about, you know, the fact that our prison system in the UK is totally at capacity. And I think we've got about 87,000 places or something like that, and about 86,000 of them have already been taken. Interestingly, 95% of them by men. So perhaps something needs to be done there. Anyway, I digress as I normally do. Right. Oh my goodness.
That was my fault, then.
Do you know what we haven't done?
What?
We haven't talked about our drinks, have we?
I know, I'm right. Open this up.
It's because I haven't done one of these podcasts so long. So Leanne and I are sat here in Leanne's house. Actually, it's a lovely house. Leanne's made me a cup of tea and she's got herself a cup of tea. And what you got?
Sprite.
You got Sprite Zero and I've got... it was like a universal opening of the bottles. I've got Ribena Light, which is the best Ribena. But I'll tell you what, right?
I do like that.
It's nice. It's good, isn't it? I like this as well. So we're all happy. I'll leave my story about... I've got into Nesquik so badly. I'm 34 years old and now I cannot go through a day without drinking a glass of milkshake, strawberry milkshake.
Oh,
and I'm starting to freak out what's going on with me. That's what lockdown's done to me, people. All right, let's get back on track. So we're now going to talk a little bit about, kind of class and crime. In particular, we're going to look at white collar crime. Leanne, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you understand by the term white collar crime?
Well, a lot of the time you might get questions about class and crime, and often we have the traditional theories like functionalism and subcultural theories that centre on working class crime, street crime, whereas white collar crime tends to be committed by middle class criminals, possibly in the office setting like you've documented here, and using their jobs to commit crime. We can divide white collar up into corporate and, what was the other one? Corporate and... Oh, there's two types. Sutherland talks about two types of white-collar crime, and now it escapes me. Now I'm on the spot.
I'm just going to keep looking at you.
Help me here.
I don't know what she's talking about. I tell you what, while you try and remember that, whenever you think of it, just shout it out, and I'll shut up.
You carry on.
White-collar crime definitely is something we associate with middle-class people because it's all related to the job that they do. And
Occupational and corporate
crime. So let's talk about occupational crime, which is basically about an individual using their position in society, so their middle-class job, their office job, and we're talking about things like, you know, lawyers, CEOs, managers, politicians or whatever, to commit crime that is going to benefit them personally, right? So, but those kind of crimes, we might be thinking about things like bribery, fraud, corruption or embezzlement, those kind of things. And they tend to be, as I say, tend to be committed by particular types of people in businesses. My example for this was about 10 years ago, we had something called the MP's expense scandal in the UK.
Oh, yes.
And basically what this is was, and it's quite hard to explain, but basically as an MP, you get given a salary. So I think let's just say for argument's sake, it's £100,000 a year. You also get given an allowance that you can spend for things that you need. So for instance, all MPs actually need a second home or somewhere they can live when they're in Parliament. So they need a gaff in London and they need a gaff in their constituency, wherever it is. Now also, they're also going to need train travel or travel time between where they live and London, because they need to be in London to do their kind of party business rather than their constituency business. Now all of these MPs had these expenses and they were told they can only use it to buy certain things like train travel second homes up to a certain value. But what came out was that a lot of these MPs were basically using their expense funds, which is essentially taxpayers' money, to buy whatever the hell they liked. Yeah. So there was people rocking swimming pools, jacuzzis, like, you know, new motors and all this kind of stuff, and stuff that basically they shouldn't have been buying. Now, they knew what they were doing, but they didn't think they were going to get caught, and they used their position in society as kind of like trustworthy MPs to like mask the fact that they were actually committing crime. Now, when this all came out, this was a huge story in the UK because it amounted to millions and millions of pounds over the years that had basically been public money stolen at a time when we were going through recession. So it didn't exactly paint politicians or MPs in a particularly good light. So that's a little bit about white-collar occupational crime. What about corporate crime, Leanne?
So corporate crime's committed by the companies themselves, so not individuals, and it's for the benefit of the companies as opposed to the individuals. So, yeah, well, you've got one here that you've talked about phone hacking.
Yeah, so, like, phone hacking, again, this is something you've probably heard of. You might not know too much about it, but basically what phone hacking is, it's when you can, through... like not telling somebody, through like tricking somebody, you can get into their phone, you can listen to their voicemails, and you can kind of, it's a bit like cracking into someone's Facebook account, but you're cracking into their phone and their voicemails and their text messages and stuff like this. Now, what happened about, I suppose about 10 years ago again now, is there was a newspaper called The News of the World, which was basically the weekend version of The Sun. And what that did was, it was a big kind of like tabloid celebrity story kind of newspaper, and it used phone hacking to hack into the voicemails of people like politicians, celebrities, members of the royal family. And most notably, and the one that really riled up the public, was the phone hacking of Millie Dowler, who was a schoolgirl who was murdered. And obviously that's very sick and weird. It's even worse, the fact that they were doing this to sell more newspapers. So it's a corporate crime because it's something that the company, the News of the World, did to benefit them and sell more newspapers. So there wasn't particularly an individual who was instinctively getting the benefit of that. It was more about the newspaper itself.
But obviously you can have corporate crimes that are just acts of negligence. So you've got things like Alton Towers. Is this the one, obviously you've written this down, and I'm assuming it's the one where the ride was stuck for ages?
Yeah, the Smiler ride.
The Smiler. Have you been on it? I don't think people were smiling at
it. No, not at all. Have you been on it? No. It is really good, I went on it before the accident, and I don't think I'd go on it now.
Can you imagine, though, being stuck on...
Oh, my goodness me. It was, like, it's horrific. So basically what happened on this Smiler ride, if you've been on it, you'll know it's an awesome roller coaster with loads of, like, loops and stuff. And back in the day before Corona hit, and we used to go to these fun places called theme parks where you'd go with people and hang out and sit next to people on a roller coaster and have fun. Back in 2015, when this happened, there was this big crash, and I'm not going to go into the ins and outs of it, but basically I think they had like two trains on the track at once, and there should have only been one. One was going around as like a test flight or a test run. And they hadn't realised that there was already one with people on it going round. Now, when the one that was a test run came to the end of the track, it just stopped. And then when the other one came up behind it, it smashed into it. And there was about 16 people were injured, two of which were significantly injured, actually had to have their legs amputated. And so what we had basically was a situation of, as Leanne said, negligence. This theme park hadn't basically put in all the safety measures in place to ensure that people could ride the roller coaster without having their legs taken off. Yeah. And so what happened basically was the theme park's owners, who were called Merlin Entertainment, were fined and required to put more regulations on the ride. So they were fined and had to pay some court costs, but also one of the people who lost their, she lost her right leg in this, was, I think she was only 16 at the time, was received compensation of £5 million.
Yeah.
I still don't think she's going to go back to Alton Towers anytime soon. Yeah. But that just indicates there. So no one actually gained from that act of negligence. It was just the fact that basically Alton Towers had not even trained their staff properly, hadn't put the money in to ensure the safety of this ride, and as a result, people were seriously injured, and that shouldn't have happened.
Sometimes it overlaps, though, because you can have acts of negligence, which is as a result of trying to gain a greater profit. So things like there was the factory, one of the Primark factories, which had known problems with its infrastructure, and it collapsed, killing a lot of the workers and things like that. And that was, again, due to a lack of health and safety measures put in place. But the reason the health and safety measures weren't put in place is because it was, you know, cost too much.
Yeah, and that's ultimately what it is. Companies will try and companies always, we know this from Marxism, that companies want to make as much profit as they can. That's the whole nature of capitalism. And one way you can do that is either by paying your workers lower wages or by reducing costs elsewhere. So it'll be things like, you know, not updating your safety equipment and those kind of things. And they're doing that at the cost of people's lives, ultimately.
Yeah, and there's loads and loads of examples of this. And, you know, it's just a case of making sure you, you know, listen to the news and keep up to date and write them down as you go along, because they're all worth AO2 points for application.
Absolutely. All right. What should we do next? We've got...
globalisation.
Yeah, why not? Do you want to lead on this
one?
Yes, yeah,
so...
Well, I
so, well, globalisation... Globalisation is a concept that you really have to get your heads around, because it features throughout the 2 years. It's in families and households, and how it affects families and households and structures and diversity within them. It's in education and how it impacts the role of education. Of course, we look at it in terms of crime and deviance. Now, obviously, making sure that you understand that globalisation is this idea that we are growing... well, that sounds a bit weird as I say growing smaller, which is... an oxymoron, isn't it?
Oh, I like that. Yeah, an oxymoron. Look at you with your English language.
It's probably wrong.
No, you're right. I think it's right.
Yeah, yeah. It's this idea that time and space is shrinking due to things like mass media, ease of travel, cheap air travel.
The internet, smartphones, global communications networks, all of these things. I always think about globalisation as made up of two things. It's the physical, so we can get around the world much easier and quicker than we've ever been able to do. Or it's the online, so being able to communicate with someone on the other side of the world. You know, we always think of this, or anyone who's listened to this will probably be like, well, yeah, obviously, because you guys have grown up with smartphones and the internet. But old people like us.
Yeah, do you remember the internet that
the
actually made it? Yeah,
and dial-up tone. Oh my God. I still remember the first time I ever went on the internet, and I thought it was absolutely amazing. Yeah. And it was in black and white as well. I can remember all of the pictures were in black and white, and I was like, this is crazy.
But that interconnectedness of the world has massive implications on cultural, social, and economic sort of spheres of life. So, in terms of crime, then. We've got to link, what I tell my students is to link the ways in which we've become globalised to crime. So if you say, right, okay, there's a growing technology that connects us together, well, then there's the capacity there for new types of crime and old types of crime to be done on a new medium. So things like cybercrime, which never existed before until we had the internet. But you've also got stalking that is performed online, which stalking has existed always. Mm. But you obviously have a new medium and a new avenue for that. So that's one way of studying that globalisation of crime. But yeah, so some examples then of transnational crimes going beyond the borders is things like sex trafficking. So Southeast Asia, there's lots of the industry there where you can, you know, sex tourism and things like that going over to these countries and actually buying a holiday where you get a different type of package holiday.
That's very diplomatically put.
You've got drugs trafficking as well. So the supply and demand of crime has become transformed, where your supply chain is global, basically. You've got body parts that can be trafficked. Trafficked? Is that a word?
Yeah, that's a word. Trafficked? Trafficked, yeah.
So an estimated 2,000 organs each year from China are sold on the black market. So if you need a new liver or whatever... Because of all that alcohol.
Oh, well, maybe. Yeah, you're right.
trafficking of artefacts as well. And that's, you know, that's gone on always, because Hitler famously used to take paintings from places that he would take over. But now, you know, you've got the internet as an outlet to be able to upload images of different artefacts that have been stolen and then buy them. And then, of course, you've got international terrorism as well on a global scale. So there's a few examples there. Just to show how, you know, this interconnectedness of the world means that lots of crimes are going on.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Leanne's given some really great examples there. I suppose you could just go back to the phone hacking thing. You could even use that as well, because without the ability of having mobile phones and the ability to communicate more widely, there would be no phone hacking.
Exactly.
So there we go.
But with crime, obviously we've looked at offending here, but of course... Globalisation has impacts on controlling crime as well. Mm. So if we've got all these new technologies, we can also use them to our advantage with surveillance, which then leads on to the problems of surveillance. Are we being over-surveilled? Is Is that right?
I think it is,
because yeah. I listened to that Spark thing last night and they talked about it.
I got told off, though, because I said, was it a podcast I did on Foucault? And I was talking,
I love Foucault.
I was talking about surveillance and the panopticon, and I was talking about surveilled, and I realised it didn't sound right. But let's go with surveilled.
We'll
and if it isn't
it.
A word, we're making it a word right now. The social construction of language. Just the other thing about like globalisation of crime as well, like thinking about one of the things that we don't really think of as a crime, but there's a great documentary on Netflix, or a great film on Netflix called The Great Hack, and you might have also seen, what's the social media one that's out at the moment? I can't remember it. But it's all about like the way that social media works and how algorithms work. But with The Great Hack, this was all about the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which basically... If you watch the movie on Netflix, it's an hour and a half long, but basically it will tell you about how the Donald Trump won the election through through social media planning, and also the way that Brexit happened was also due to what happened on social media. And basically this was all about stealing people's data to understand who they are and then plot how they're going to vote and these kind of things. So again, it's sort of like privacy and all that kind of stuff.
And of course, you can link white collar and corporate crime to globalisation, and people like Marxists like Lash and Uri, who talk about globalisation being accompanied by at a time where we've become, you know, increasingly interconnected. It's accompanied at a time where we've got less state regulation over businesses and finance, which has then opened up the avenue for corporations to commit fraudulent activities. And then if you couple that with the same time where state provision has gone down, you then open up for white-collar working-class crime, because obviously state provision goes down, welfare benefits go down, and then you've got blocked opportunities, and it goes back to your subcultural stuff. So it's all connected.
Absolutely, and that also connects to neoliberalism as well, the moving back of the government and the encouragement of a free market. So all of this stuff does link up. It's just about seeing those links, isn't it, sometimes. Should we talk about state crime?
Yeah.
Cool. So, state crimes are basically, well, we've just talked about like white collar and corporate crime. Like, if you know corporate crime is about a business committing a crime for the benefit of the business, a state crime is essentially the state or the government committing crime to benefit them or their citizens. And state crimes, that might be something else. State crimes can vary and range from crimes on a massive scale, like kind of war crimes or genocide or acts of terrorism and things like that, that completely, you know, massive events that everyone will hear about, to things that kind of contravene human rights, like the use of torture or imprisonment or people trafficking. Again, these kind of things, you know, imprisonment without trial. So it's something that affects people on both the macro scale in society. So think of a war, that's not just going to affect one person, but also on the individual scale in things like, for instance, slavery, or indeed using torture to extract information out of people.
And it's important when you're revising state crime that you don't just think of evil dictatorships and things like that, because obviously state crime is a global problem, and it happens in the UK, in the USA, as well as these sorts of more third world countries.
Now, one of the things I find interesting, and I'm going to try and like couple back to when we talked about relativity and social constructionism of crime earlier on, and we said basically, you know, different nations or communities or societies or whatever can create whatever crime, create the laws that they like, and therefore a crime in that country is a crime because someone has said it's a crime. This is why it's quite difficult to kind of like pin governments down on state crimes, because governments themselves can basically define what is and what isn't legal. And so it's very difficult for what we might call supranational bodies like the UN or the EU to come down on those countries to stop state crimes, because technically they are within the law in their own state. So it's very difficult. I'm just going to throw in one quick example here as well, because Leanne mentioned, don't just think about your evil dictators, and we tend to think of the non-Western states as being those kind of dictatorships. But very briefly, I mean, you can tell that, you know, it's been not long ago, it's been summer, it's been lockdown, because I've watched a hell of a lot on Netflix recently. And one of the shows I watched on there, actually, it was a movie on Netflix called, it's a documentary. It's all about the Challenger space shuttle disaster. And basically in 1986, there was in America, what they call NASA, launched a space shuttle, and unfortunately it kind of exploded about a minute and a half into its launch. And what happened with this, it killed everyone on board, because it was a terrible accident. You can see the footage online, go and look it up, it's horrendous. But why this was a state crime is because it was ultimately the US government and NASA who are an independent agency of the US government, they colluded to keep the details of why this happened a secret. Because what they wanted to do is, this is at the time where the whole thing that the space race was still going on, this is like 35 years ago or whatever, and they wanted to protect the integrity and the credibility of NASA on the global scale. So what they did was they kind of covered up why this accident happened and started to kind of like say, oh, we don't really know, it's difficult to say, because they didn't want to admit, again, their negligence on this
part. Just culture of denial.
Absolutely, yeah. And so what it was, basically, was they hadn't basically bought the right parts. That sounds so basic, doesn't it? But they hadn't had the right material for something that goes around the, I can't remember what it's called, the bit that blasts off, that like eroded.
And because it was, your day job.
Don't worry. My C in science at GCSE is very much safe in my pocket, and it's never going to improve, tell me. I don't even know how the lights work, you know what I mean? Like, some switches are like, well, how does that work? Never mind, that's my... Yeah, I'm all right at sociology, but don't look at me for science advice, or don't even ask me what like a maths question is, because I'm going to fail miserably. Let's move on swiftly before I just dig myself into a deeper hole. What else have we got now? Is it just green crime to talk
just
about?
Just green crime.
Just a bit of green crime.
So having a look at green crimes, again, it all links in, so you can link this back to globalisation, because with the increase of transnational corporations going global, it can bring extra... problems like environmental damage. So you get a lot of the time case studies where these big companies have spillages or all sorts, and the most obvious one being the BP oil spill of 2010. And there is a film that's linked to that. That's, what's it called?
Deepwater Horizon.
That's the one.
Yeah, that's the one. I think it's on Prime's one. It might be on Netflix, I don't know. But that's really good, because it, like, watching that movie, I didn't really know a huge deal about this before. I'd heard of it, but watching that movie, which was like an hour and a half, it's complete trash. But it's an enjoyable movie to watch, but it really helped me understand why this was both a corporate crime and a green crime, because the effect of it was horrendous. I mean, 11 people died, 17 people got injured, and 5 million barrels worth of oil were dumped into the Gulf of Mexico, and it's been one of the biggest oil spills ever. Why did this happen? Again, it comes down to negligence on the part of the companies who were supposed to be running that oil rig and working on it, because they didn't want to pay for it repairs and regulatory changes to happen. They just went ahead and drilled, and the drill kind of, I don't know the proper
snapped.
Term, it snapped. Yeah, that's the, I think that's the technical term, isn't it? In geology, it snapped off. So you know, and that caused, you know, widespread environmental disasters as well as the loss of human life. And it's just not... It's a blooming crime that happens, because the damage that was caused by it was huge. And in fact, I think this is the biggest ever settlement in a green crime case. $18.7 billion BP had to pay as part of that. And BP weren't the only stakeholder in that. There was a couple of other groups. One was called Transocean, one was called Halliburton. Yes, and so they've also had to pay massive amounts out. So we are talking really big.
But it was a massive, massive oil spillage, though. You could see it from space. They even, you know, when it all happened and they were doing the news reports on it, you could see from space the... What's that place up?
Space. The moon.
the thing that goes around the world all the time. And then
the moon.
No!
it's satellite?
Where the people go on board and they were taking photos of it.
Like the space station.
That's the one. It? Yeah. And they took photos of it to show how... how big the spillage was. So there you go.
Yeah. Right, so what we've done today then, we're getting a little bit silly now, so we're probably going to draw it to a close. But we've had a lovely time doing this, and I hope you've enjoyed it and found something interesting. Just to recap what we've gone over today. So we've gone over the difference between crime and deviance. We've talked a little bit about situational crime, and the differences between historic crime, cross-cultural crime, and how ultimately we're talking about crime being relative in that it's a social construct. So it changes according to time, place, and culture throughout the world. We gave you an overview of the criminal justice system in the UK, and we talked about how it's not just the police and the courts that are involved. You've also got the Crown Prosecution Service and the penal system involved in that. We discussed about white-collar crime, and we eventually managed to remember the difference
two
between...
types, yeah.
What are they again?
Occupational and corporate.
Corporate and occupational crime. time. So occupational benefiting the individual and corporate benefiting the actual corporation. We moved on then to talk about globalization of crime, made some links between things like online crimes and offline crimes. And Leanne told us about how, was it, how many body parts was it? That's been
2,000.
2,000 that have come out, 2,000 organs come out of, have been trafficked out of China on average. And that's all we know about, isn't it, presumably?
Exactly, yeah.
So that's pretty scary. So the dark figure of crime coming in there as well. Yeah. We talked about state crime. We gave the examples of, you know, perhaps some sort of non-Western examples, as well as the Challenger space shuttle disaster and NASA in 1986. And we just finished off there by going over a bit about green crimes, talking a bit about the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and giving the example there of how BP's negligence created them paying back one of the largest fines ever. So I hope what we've done in this podcast is just given you a bit of an overview as to some of these key terms and ideas, showing you how some of them link together. I think particularly around this concept of globalization, which Leanne said, you know, it doesn't go away in sociology, it's always going to be there. And to think about how we can apply some I don't know why that came out so weird, how we can apply some examples to it. So hopefully you found that interesting. If you have, do us a favour, would you? Give us a 5-star review on iTunes or subscribe on Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from, because that makes me look good. that's about it from us. Have you got anything to say, Leanne, before we finish?
I haven't, no, but thank you. And thank you for bearing with me when I forgot those two terms.
Oh, don't be ridiculous. I think she was only doing it for the audio anyway. And Leanne's got some very fetching nail polish on today.
Thank you.
What colour's that? What do they
call
it?
This is called Berry.
Berry. It's like a sort of...
It's very nice.
It is very nice, isn't it? It's like a cross between like a pink, a fuchsia, and a red. It's lovely. I haven't got any nail polish on, but that,
shame.
You know, that's how we go. So anyway, thanks very much for listening to episode number 17 of the Take One podcast. I've been Ben, she's been Leanne, and we will see you again very soon. Bye.
Bye.
So that's it for another episode of the Take One podcast from All Sociology. If you like this podcast or learn something from it, then there's loads of ways you can help me. And the best thing is, none of them will cost you a penny. So do me a favour and subscribe to the podcast wherever you found it. Tell your mates who do sociology about it. Or tell your mates who don't do sociology about it. Rate it 5 stars on iTunes or whatever, and go and follow me on social media. Search All Sociology, ALLSOCIOLOGY, all one word, and you'll find me. Peace out and enjoy yourselves.